From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now, here's your host, Mark Kepler.
The Governor's Office of Emergency Services is responsible for overseeing and coordinating emergency preparedness, response, recovery, and homeland security activities in California. That includes everything from dealing with severe droughts and floods, to raging fires, to the next big California earthquake, as well as acts of terrorism and cybersecurity. How prepared is California for these natural and man-made disasters? We'll ask Christina Curry from the California Office of Emergency Services. We'll also talk to Pedro Nava, chair of the nonpartisan Little Hoover Commission, which recently issued a report that questions the state's historical, and perhaps wrong-headed, approach to managing California's forest fires.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. Chevron's Coalinga oil field and Fresno County have been doing side by side for over 100 years. Learn more at doers.com. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. California is unique in the type of possible natural disasters that could happen. Is the state ready? Our guest should know. She is Tina Curry, the Deputy Director of the State Office of Emergency Services. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Thank you.
So, can you give us a little background about your office?
Well, our office is part of state government, as you said, and it serves an important function, and that is to get California ready for disasters, which obviously, as we'll talk about later, we have many here in our great state. And really part of that being a state office that has that responsibility is working with all the communities in California that we represent, but also with other people who might help us. So the federal government often comes into play when there's a disaster, but also other states. So we're really that broker in between. And also we have the ability to work with the rest of state government, which is, in many cases, lending a hand to the disaster response.
Sounds like a pretty big coordination.
It is. It's a big coordination.
Let me ask you about this. So, we had those hurricanes, Harvey and Irma, a while ago, expected to hit about $200 billion in damages between the two of them. Federal government's going to pay most of that, but state and local governments are going to be the hook for some of that money as well. You know, tens of millions, hundreds maybe of millions of dollars. Does California have a general emergency fund that they could tap in the event of a disaster? How much is in that fund if they have it?
Well, California has an emergency disaster program. So what that entails will depend on the event. So part of it is to come into play, to cost share, if you will, with the federal government when those FEMA dollars are available. And sometimes it's the only disaster funding program in maybe a smaller scale disaster where FEMA doesn't come into the picture. So, but it's a distributed system. So local government has a part of it, the state of California has a part of it, and the federal government, if we reach something to that magnitude, will have a part of it as
well. And I know they put some money aside for fires, but they can blow through that money, burn through that money pretty quickly because, in 2017, lots of fires.
Right.
That's been a big problem. So the federal's share of financial assistance could possibly change. Mm-hmm. I wonder if President Trump and the congressional Republicans are looking to cut budgets. What's he proposing and how could that possibly impact California?
Well, I'm not a party to, kind of what's being contemplated at the federal government level. We certainly would advocate that that these dollars are important, as they have been in the past, for disasters and emergencies. They will continue to occur. But it is something that's a shared responsibility. The state of California has a part of it, like I mentioned. But maybe we'll talk about it a little bit later. What's important is also doing work to protect ourselves against it, to bring that cost down if we can. Obviously, saving lives is the most important, but we also reducing the threat of damages and destruction is part of our goal as well.
So being proactive.
Absolutely.
About some of those things. So, it's not like planning for natural disasters is exclusively a state government responsibility. Mm-hmm. The federal government's requiring local governments to engage in these things called local hazard mitigation planning. What does that entail?
A local hazard mitigation plan is a community's commitment to risk reduction. So one of the ways that we enable that in California is we provide funding for it to actually do the planning work. And also it is a condition of receiving the federal disaster grants is that planning has been done up front. And that's important. Again, it's communities recognizing their risk and taking measures if they can to invest towards the reduction of those. Again, that will save lives, that protects property, that breaks the cycle of repetitive disasters. So that's a really big focus. Actually, that's an area that falls under my portfolio, is to help to get those local hazard mitigation plans done throughout California. And they need to be updated every few years because things change.
Right.
Populations grow, risks change over time. So it's a constant cycle.
So is there like a best practice template that, mm-hmm. that cities or locales can use?
We actually publish ones, for these plans that are completed. If we have something that's really a good example, we put those online so that communities can kind of see something that somebody else has done, but also encourage them to work together as these are being developed so that we are always sharing those best practices.
So it's kind of a coordination function. Yeah. So the counties are putting these plans together, yeah. for example, are talking to other counties,
absolutely,
seeing which
yeah.
Which of these plans seem to be the best, and then yeah. using those.
Yeah,
as a template.
But that's not a substitute for community involvement there on the ground. They know their community. The people of that community should have a stake and a voice in that planning. So it's a combination of having the unique character of the local area reflected in the plan, but also using best practices.
So there are stakeholders that are also involved in this plan. Isn't just an Office of Emergency Services that's doing
right.
this. They're involving community members.
Yeah. We actually require that there's community input in the local mitigation plan, not just all the cities in an area, but also the community members themselves, as well as other departments in the local area. So if you think about a disaster or risk management for a disaster, you have public works, you have the health department, you have lots of other entities with subject expertise that have a vested interest in protection of
that community.
I think
people don't realize that sometimes when you talk about public works, for example, yeah. if you have an interruption of electricity, for example,
right.
streetlights might go out, or
right.
a major earthquake.
Yeah.
Those are all things you got to consider.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, up next, we're going to talk about the severe drought that California experienced, mm-hmm. also some flooding recently. Is the state prepared for that contingency? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. In California, we need to be prepared for both droughts and floods. Our guest is Tina Curry with the Office of Emergency Services, whose focus is really protecting the state from either disaster. So in 2014, Governor Brown declared a drought emergency. That ended in 2017. What would you say to those who argue that droughts really are no longer a temporary thing? They're really a permanent condition that we need to deal with.
Well, I don't disagree with that. Even though they don't occur with that magnitude all the time, what resulted from this latest drought that I was involved with the response and recovery is really a realization that there should be a new normal about water conservation, that water is not something that we can count on necessarily to have in the supply that we need it. And as our population grows in California, the need for water is going to be greater. So on the one hand, what came out of the drought from 2014 and 17 is, first of all, it lasted a long time. That wasn't a disaster that was over with in a couple of weeks or something that we could bounce back from quickly. But also that that way of life of living with conservation minded really makes a lot of sense, so that we can prevent the impacts from being as severe when it does happen.
It's interesting. I can't tell you how many, I'm sure maybe in your neighborhood as well, so many neighbors changed mm-hmm. their lawns to
they
drought
did.
Tolerant. It was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And so that really did have an impact
right.
on folks,
yeah.
and that'll pay off for years to come. As we're talking about water, let's talk about the Oro Dam spillway, mm-hmm. experienced a failure in 2016, resulted in some flooding in some surrounding communities. What caused the break, and what is the state doing to rectify the situation so it doesn't happen again?
Well, we went from not enough water to too much,
right.
just almost overnight. I think the cause for the break is something that our Department of Water Resources is working on to investigate, to find out. What Cal OES is focused on is really preparing for and, of course, managing the consequences, if regardless of the type of catastrophe that occurs. So part of what came out of that are some new responsibilities to our office, to work on emergency plans related to dams throughout California. There's many of them. Oroville is just one. And right. when I mean emergency plans, meaning how are when those if those incidents happen in the future, or if there's some kind of an incident at a dam, how are the communities that are downstream from those notified in a rapid manner of what's happening so that they can take action?
You actually have inundation maps. So kind of it says, well, okay, if the water, if it spills over, here's where it's going, right? Yes. And they're supposed to make sure those plans are updated, like every, 10 years or so?
Yeah, that's the minimum. So depending on the severity of the, or I'm sorry, the criticality of the dam is sort of the due date for the different plans, because there are some that have more impact than others if something were to occur. So between the maps and the emergency planning, those are some new programs that are in place now.
Topic of flooding. Let's talk about one of the great fears of a lot of people have. If we have a big earthquake, what is it going to do to the levees in the Delta? It could result, obviously, in catastrophic damage in the immediate area, but we're also talking about interrupting, perhaps ending water supplies for farmers in the valley, people in Southern California. What's the state doing to prepare for a possible collapse of the levees?
Well, what we do is we're preparing for large magnitude earthquakes that will potentially cause a lot of things that are extremely critical and extremely disruptive to happen, including impact to the levees and potentially the water system. So what we do when we develop these plans is we look at all the potential impacts, how we would prioritize all the many problems that would occur in order to start addressing those. So one of them is planning for potential water system disruptions as a result of an earthquake. How would we then help to rectify that in the short term, meaning making sure that we have water supplies so that people can be safe, and then while we're restoring any type of longer term impacts at the same time. So that's kind of sort of the short version, but we look at it much more comprehensively by the entire risk and all of the kind of interlocking impacts of those, and then how we would mobilize the state, federal government, private sector to start working through those impacts, kind of starting with the most severe impacts to life safety and then working our way all the way through the recovery, and sheltering of people and other things that are important, but, maybe not at that life safety level. And these plans, we're constantly looking at these scenarios, developing those plans, enlisting the people who would need to help with that response, and then updating them.
Yeah, it's interesting. According to my notes, the levees have never been really designed or tested for this cataclysmic earthquake that could occur. And we're talking about 500,000 people that live in the immediate area, 23 million people who rely on water from the Delta, and 17% of all farmland in the United States relying on the Delta water. That's a big deal.
It's a big deal. Yeah.
Last question in the second before we get out of this, and that is I want to talk about climate change. There have been some reports about, hey, California's doing a great job of addressing, trying to stop climate change from happening, but not enough on the effects of climate change, like intense floods, droughts, fires. Are you factoring climate change into your analysis?
We absolutely are. Cal OES is actually very much involved in that. We see that as part of disaster readiness, which changes over time. We had a smaller population, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. Now we have a much larger one. Climate impacts are changing the character of disaster, compounded by population growth. So we're always looking and revisiting how we do disaster planning. It's not the same thing that it was. And, part of that is anticipating the impacts. More frequent droughts for longer duration. We've had a lot of severe wildfires. If that trend continues and these disasters continue to become more severe, we have to plan for that. The same thing isn't going to work.
Yeah, it's amazing. I think in your report, when I was looking, I'm looking this up somewhere, I found that dead trees in California, that's a major problem. That's a matchstick waiting to go off. Yeah. 102 million dead trees that could be the next wildfire. So big problem. But up next, we're going to talk about another problem. That's the big one, California earthquake. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. The U.S. Geological Survey has published a hypothetical scenario of what a 7.8 magnitude earthquake on the San Andreas Fault would do. The death toll, they say, would be the worst natural disaster in U.S. history, with approximately 1,800 people dying. Knowing that something's going to happen, it's inevitable. We just don't know where and when. Has probably got a lot of Californians a little anxious. So, is California prepared for the big one? Our guest is Tina Curry with the State Office of Emergency Services. Can you briefly describe the difference between earthquake magnitude and earthquake intensity?
Well, I'm not a scientist, but what I understand is the, you know, the difference between the shaking of an earthquake that's felt, and that has a lot to do with, you know, how far, the type of fault that it was and sort of the depth of it.
You want to be so far away from the epicenter, right?
You want to be far away, that's good, but also, you know, depending on the depth is how that will and how that ruptures to the surface. But I'm not a scientist. We work closely with the science community to understand that so that our office can do our job, which is to prepare and also plan for the consequences.
So what are the probabilities that this is going to happen? Well, something big is going to happen.
Something big is going to happen. You know, there's numbers. The numbers are very high, but the way
in the next 30 years, there's a 99% chance that you're going to have a 6.7 magnitude earthquake.
Yeah. So let's
That's
just
a
say,
high
yeah,
probability.
Yeah. The way we look at it is, it is almost certain that an earthquake is going to happen. So let's plan for it. Let's be ready, because you can see that it's happening all around us in different parts of the world. These are very real, and they've happened before in California. So we're planning for them as if they're a certainty. But you're right, we don't know timing. So that's the part of it, is being ready now for something that could happen at any time at a very, at a high magnitude with a lot of consequences.
I'm thinking 99% is pretty much you're assured.
We're pretty sure.
So, but you can't actually predict, when an earthquake's going to happen. Mm-hmm. But you can do some things, right? You can improve building standards.
Right.
You can implement some kind of early warning system, which has happened a few places around
the
world. So how much warning, if you had an early warning system, how much warning would it provide given today's technology? And is it worth the effort, the cost?
It's absolutely worth the effort. How much warning you have is, like you said earlier, depends on how far you are away from the quake. The farther you are from the quake, from the epicenter, the more warning you're going to have as the sort of signal and the information moves through the system. It's all going to be very fast, and really the best, the greatest amount of warning at this point is we're planning for is about a minute, but it could just be a few seconds.
It doesn't sound like a lot of time.
It doesn't sound like a lot of time, but when you think about what you could do, if you actually kind of pretended like an earthquake was going to happen with no notice, you would drop, cover, and hold on. Imagine if you had 10 seconds of warning. It would actually give you a chance to stop, think about it, and get to safety. So a few seconds can actually go by, can actually do a lot. There's also automated responses that an early warning system can do, and that's really where this becomes important. Stopping trains, stopping manufacturing lines, getting workers to safety. You know, those few seconds could mean a lot in terms of damages and losses avoided, people getting to safety where they wouldn't have had that kind of notice before, hospitals and surgeons stopping procedures. There's a whole lot that could be
happening. So if you have a minute to notice, that really is enough time to take care of that situation.
Yes.
But, you know, this system's going to cost money. Who's going to pay for it? And what's the cost-benefit analysis? So it's going to cost X number of millions of dollars.
Right.
Has anybody done an evaluation of how much that would actually save? Because there's a lot of, you're talking about a lot of different ways it could impact people.
Yeah. We've done a lot of analysis on the benefits of such a system. We've seen them be put into place in other countries and how those have performed. And we've actually made some investment. First of all, California already has a network of sensors that are detecting earthquakes and giving us their magnitude in real time now. We would build earthquake early warning right on top of that, so we're not starting from scratch. The second is the U.S. Geologic Service and the state of California have invested. The governor authorized $10 million towards the installation and improving of that sensor network about a year or so ago. So we're building that as we speak to make that available for Californians. And then ongoing, we're still assessing what that cost would be and how that would be paid for. But really, when you start seeing the value of this and either the injuries saved, the lives saved, the dollars saved by avoiding losses, when you compare to not having a system, the numbers really are going to add up, especially when it comes to safety of people, safety of the workforce. And we've done an assessment through all the any sector you can think of in the state that could benefit from this. And by and large, they agree that this has huge benefits for public safety. So so we really believe that it's there. And the fact that we have a system to build off of and that other countries have done it, really, it makes a lot of sense for California to do this. And we have that certainty that an earthquake will occur.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was reading the U.S. Geological Service says it would cost about $12 million a year for a California warning system, which if you think about the state budget, $180 billion, that is literally a drop in the bucket. It seems to make some sense.
It does, and if you think about, again, what could be saved, you know, that in the fact that we live with earthquake risk, and here is a change in that condition where we can do something about it, where before it had been without notice, and we just had to accept that, this is really huge advancement.
One quick question I want to get in here before we end this segment, that is, anything we should know that you don't think we already know about dealing with earthquakes? Like, a lot of people think standing in the middle of a door jam is a good idea.
It's not a good idea. Really, what we recommend, and I hope everybody knows this in California, and that is you should drop, cover, and hold on. Protect your head. Get under a sturdy piece of furniture. Because one of the largest cause of injuries is things flying off the walls and may seem relatively
benign. Get underneath a street table.
Absolutely. And that really can protect you. And maybe feels like not intuitive, you know, when something bad happens, our instinct might be not to do that, but that really is the safest thing to do. So I hope all Californians will remember that and practice it.
Good advice. Up next, we're going to talk about some new age threats, terrorism and cybersecurity. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Tina Curry with the State Office of Emergency Services. So what about man-made disasters? And we're thinking terrorist attacks. What does the state do before, during, and after a terrorist attack? What would they do in terms of coordination with federal and local authorities?
Well, it certainly is a reality today. This has happened in California. It's happened elsewhere in the country and world. Cal OES has a role in that. We are the Homeland Security Office as well as the Emergency Management Office. And we have an intelligence center or intelligence network, I should say, that has a statewide office, but also different regional offices that we work with throughout California that are constantly monitoring what's happening so that to the extent possible, we can be aware and prevent and interdict if for any types of threats for Homeland Security. But we also plan for consequences of actions, whatever those might be. And that, you know, and the threat of that is constantly evolving. We sort of don't know what will
happen.
Sounds
like a close relationship between you and the federal
Absolutely.
Office.
Yeah. Definitely a close relationship with the federal. This is, you know, because this is a national security concern, and Homeland Security is something that is a very serious.
Well, let me ask you something. I never thought I'd have to ask someone in this day and age, and that is the threat of a nuclear attack. You're hearing these bellicose threats from North Korea. Is that possible? I guess it is possible. Have you prepared at all for the possibility of a nuclear attack?
Well, we look at, again, as there's a lot of things that are unknown in California in terms of, you know, whether it's a natural hazard or a human-caused one. And really, it's important for people to understand, you know, that risk exists in California. Our state is great for many more reasons than it is than known for disasters, but it's a reality in our state, including for nuclear. We had up until recently two active nuclear power plants in the state. One has shut down, one is still active, and we do a lot of planning with the communities around there just in case there could be an accident. So it's really important for Californians just to be aware, to understand there's information about, you know, how to be prepared for these types of risks. And of course we would do everything we can to prevent it or hope that it doesn't happen, but, you know, there's really no downside to being prepared as individual. And we have some great tools on our website that go down to the address where a person can actually look and see what they're at risk to at their home, at their work, and they need to talk to their families about these things. And how would you reunite and reconnect after disaster, and maybe our cell phones won't be working for a while.
It's amazing. I'm a child of the 60s, and you know, when I'm growing up, that was still a possibility. And you know, go out to the hallway and cover your head. And it's hard to believe that in this day and age, we're still talking about that, or it's coming back. Let me ask you about cybersecurity. It's another emerging issue, and that's really protecting kind of the vital infrastructure of the state against cyber attacks. It also includes, frankly, the electoral process and attacks there. What are you doing along those lines?
Well, we have a cybersecurity integration center that is another component of Cal OES, and that's bringing the whole plethora of agencies that you know, have a role in cyber protection. You know, whether it's for the state's infrastructure, law enforcement, the federal government, all coming together to do similarly, like with Homeland Security, to be assessing the threats, rapidly responding if something does occur, and you know, making sure that we're recovering from those and preventing new attacks from occurring to the extent we can. But again, a lot of that comes down to personal readiness. There's a lot that the individual can do to protect their information because this is a reality.
Yeah, so cybercrime is a reality. Do you have actually some people in your office that are experts in hacking and those kinds of things that can kind of look at that and see what the potential threats are in cybercrime?
I would imagine they know a thing or two about how that works, but we also enlist expertise like that to, you know, test our own systems, test our own readiness and test the readiness throughout California just to see what those vulnerabilities are so that we can plan and protect against them.
You know, it's pretty amazing. When you do get, you may have had this experience, most of us have, when you do get hacked, you know, that is really problematic. So I guess the advice would be don't open up things you don't know.
Absolutely.
Be careful about it because you could end up losing all of your information on your computer. People are very reliant on those these days.
Yeah, and it's really important to be aware if something looks funny that comes through your email. You know, I'm hoping that people are more cognizant of that about opening links. And again, we have a lot of information on our web about
how to protect yourself. I would encourage people to go to your website because you literally do. You can put in your zip code and you can find out exactly what potential hazards you need to be aware of. So that's very, very helpful. Yeah. I want to thank Tina Curry with Office of Emergency Services. Thank you for joining us. If you want to stay current with state and local politics, you can sign up to on our website for our Maddie Daily, or you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition on KMJ.
Up next, is California's approach to forest fires all wrong? We'll ask Pedro Nava, chair of the nonpartisan Little Hoover Commission, which recently issued a report that questions the state's historical, and perhaps wrong-headed, approach to managing California's forest fires. The cost of fighting forest fires is escalating dramatically. In just 6 months alone, California's firefighting costs topped $700 million. And it now consumes more than half of the U.S. Forest Service budget. What can be done? We'll ask. Pedro Nava, chair of the nonpartisan Little Hoover Commission. Fighting fire with fire. Rethinking forest management.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. Chevron's Coalinga oil field and Fresno County have been doing side by side for over 100 years. Learn more at doers.com. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. Recently, California has been hit by historic forest fires. In fact, Governor Jerry Brown has described wildfires as now being a year-long phenomenon. Some think a factor may be how we've managed our forests, suggesting that we should literally fight fire with fire. That was a finding of a recent report by the Little Hoover Commission. The chair of the Little Hoover Commission, Pedro Nava, is our guest. Welcome to the Maddie Report.
Thank you very much.
So let's talk about the size of the Sierra Nevada forest. How big is it and how big a problem is this?
Well, the Sierra Nevadas are about 10 million acres in the Sierra Nevada. And in fact, California's forests comprise a full one-third of our land mass. So it's a significant portion of the state.
Put it in perspective, that's the size of New York, you said in your report.
Well, I mean...
That's a large size.
Well, it is a resource that really isn't recognized, I think, by most Californians because it's not right in their backyard. But it contributes so much to our economic vitality and our environmental health as well.
Yeah, and you were saying in your report that about 60% of the Sierra Nevada forest has really got a problem, too.
Well, we have, most of the people who think about the Sierra Nevadas and a problem, so to speak, are focused on the bark beetle. And in fact, that's why we first became interested in it. But when we started to look at the impacts of the bark beetle, we realized it was just a symptom. It is just one of the issues that is of a problem for our forest, but it goes much deeper than that. It goes all the way to forest management. And if we're going to have healthy forests, we're going to have to become directly involved in what we do with our forests.
So you were saying, so we got here, it wasn't just the bark beetle. You talked about in your report about the drought and policy. Talk a little bit about the policy issue just briefly.
Yeah, this is very interesting because it's one of those sorts of things where it was well-intentioned back in the early 1900s. They had had wildfires in other parts of the country, and so there was a federal policy that was promulgated. And the federal policy is important because 57% of California's forests belong to the federal government. We think we control our forests, but we only have 2% of it. About 35% is owned by private parties. So 57% of the forest owned by the feds. And the feds created in the 1900s a policy on fire suppression. In other words, if you have a fire, you got to put it out. So the first rule was, we don't
want... Which seems logical.
Well, I mean, it does. And if you're living in the forest and if you're at risk, then you want that fire put out. Mm-hmm. And so they went from 10 acres, put it out, to the fire must be put out by 10 o'clock the next morning. Now, the consequences of that is exactly why we are in the situation where we are now. Because this policy to put out all fires right away has resulted in essentially making an unnatural forest.
Yeah. So why do you want a healthy forest? What's why do healthy forests even matter?
Well, healthy forests matter because of air quality, for example, and also because 60% of California's watersheds are located in the forest. And when you have the catastrophic fires that we have been experiencing for many, many years now, and if we don't change what we're doing, we're going to continue to experience them, that impacts our water quality and it impacts our air quality. California is very focused on reducing greenhouse gases.
It's interesting that in your report, which I did not know, that the carbon capture and storage is a significant part of the role that forests play.
Well, healthy forests. I think that's important.
Right.
A role that the forests play, a healthy forest plays, is carbon capture. And let me give you an example. Because it's the kind of forest that we have now. Back in the day, before the policy, the federal policy, a forest would have anywhere from 50 to 80 trees per acre. Large trees, healthy trees, strong bark. We now have anywhere from 300 to 400 trees per acre. Now you're thinking that's terrific, more trees. They're the wrong kind of trees. Because with a healthy forest, taller trees actually have gaps up in the canopy. So that allows rain to reach the soil, that allows snow to reach the soil, that allows sunshine to reach the soil, which helps with all of the processes that are important for that. A crowded forest, 300 to 400 per acre, you have small trees. They're not as healthy, and they are more subject to catching fire and therefore creating the greater catastrophe.
Yeah, so you say that, you know, we noted earlier that the federal government controls much of this land. So what is the state going to do? What can the state do?
The state is going to take advantage, as they have been doing, of the good neighbor policy that we have with the federal government. And so that calls for and provides for cooperation between the state of California and the federal government in managing the forest. And California has been doing a good job of that in the areas where they've been able to. It requires additional cooperation with the feds. And remember, 35% of our forests belong in private or held in private hands. You got to work with those folks too. But what the state can do is be the catalyst to help bring these things together.
The other thing you mentioned in your report, though, is fire suppression is also the cost of fire suppression are going up.
Yeah. You know, we talk about forest fires, we call them, as well as prescribed burns and managed burns. So a prescribed burn is a situation where you have personnel that are specifically trained in the techniques. They cooperate with communities. They work with air quality. A prescribed burn costs about $200 an acre. $200
an acre. What does fire suppression cost?
About $830.
Well, there you go.
Right.
That's quite a big difference. We're going to talk more about that in a minute. Is fire management the answer to wildfires? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. According to a recent report issued by the California's Nonpartisan Little Hoover Commission, quote, for 100 years, a culture of fire suppression in California forests has led to disastrous results, unquote. Instead, they recommend that the state literally fight fire with fire. The chair of the Little Hoover Commission, Pedro Nava, is our guest here to explain that recommendation. So you're talking about more frequent, low-intensity, talked about prescribed and managed fires is better than fire suppression or mechanical thinning. Why?
Well, let me correct something. I called it the good neighbor policy before. It's a good neighbor authority. But anyway, comparing prescribed fire compared to fire suppression. We all know fire suppression. That's when all the trucks roll out because you've got this disastrous fire that's burning up hundreds and thousands of acres.
And you still think that's necessary where fires are near neighborhoods, of course.
Well, yeah, we're not saying that you know, too bad, you're in a place where there's a fire, you know, get over it. We're saying that when you've got life at risk and you've got significant infrastructure that has to be protected, well then, yeah, of course, you go put out the fire. But the point is that if you engage in fire management practices and forest management practices in advance, you're less likely to have the super fires that we have now. So a prescribed burn is when you have firefighters that are specifically trained in that kind of project who work with the Air Resources Board to identify the best time to have a prescribed fire. You can go through and at the cost of about $200 an acre, remove the underbrush, which is creating the threat, because in many areas, it's been there for 100 years. And it's dense, and it burns hot, and it quite literally destroys the soil.
So talk a bit more about how fire-adapted forests are actually healthier.
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing, because when I think about the forest and what I used to see, you see large trees, anywhere from 40 to 60 to 100 feet tall, who have very dense bark. Now, those are trees that have grown up with natural fire conditions. A natural fire thins out the vegetation on the forest floor. It also burns up what they call duff, which is like the bark and the rest of the debris, so to speak, that's on the forest floor. And you need to get rid of that stuff because it has an impact on the health of the tree. Large trees are stronger, they are more resilient, their bark is more fire resistant. They have the ability to resist a pest like a bark beetle.
Well, let me ask you this. Do you have any data that supports this idea that a natural fire approach is better than fire suppression?
Yeah, there is a significant amount of research that has been done in this by scientists that have devoted their careers to it. So yes, it's very firmly well established in the literature that in order to have a healthy, resilient forest, you have to have this kind of fire.
I think I actually read in your report there was a study done by a UC Berkeley professor who compared this mountain. One side was on the Mexican side, one side was on the American side. The Mexican side led it to a natural burn. The Americans did this kind of, you know, fire suppression.
Right.
Much healthier forest on the Mexican side.
Right. And I'm really very pleased that you've read the report in such detail. But you're absolutely right. We had this unique scenario where half of the forest was in the United States and the other half of the forest was in Mexico. On the United States side, they put the fires out and put the fires out, put the fires out. On the Mexican side, they had fires every so often, so it cleared out the underbrush. And the forest was healthier on the Mexican side. Then they had the drought came. Mm-hmm. And even with the consequences of the drought, the researchers found that the Mexican forest that had had fires still was in better shape than the American side.
Well, talk a little bit about this kind of managed fire, the fires that occur naturally and allowed to burn.
Well, those are primarily going to occur in areas of wildlands.
Kind of like remote areas.
Well, that's where it makes the most sense.
Right.
So I think if you give thought to prescribed fires, which are those fires which are closely managed by fire-trained personnel, and the other natural sort of fires, those are going to tend to take place further away from centers of population.
So what are some of the challenges? And let's talk about prescribed fires, where you're controlling where the fire is.
Right.
What are the challenges to doing prescribed fires?
Well, part of the challenge is getting the public to understand that it's actually preferable than to just allow the forest to grow in the way it's been growing, where you then have the consequences of a super fire, so to speak.
And there, I think people are worried that if you have a prescribed fire, that all of a sudden it's going to get out of control and it's going to go into neighborhoods. But that's not really the case.
Well, as in most of life, there's nothing is 100% certain.
Right.
But with prescribed fires, you have again personnel, firefighters who have been trained in those techniques, who have identified the areas that are the best candidates for prescribed burns. You then work in conjunction with the Air Resources Board because you want to do this on a day. You don't want to do it on a day where the air quality is already bad.
Right.
And then you want to do it with the geological services and the weather services, because you want to have some sense of how the winds are going to blow.
And an interesting thing, it was also, I did do a deep dive into your report, there were 16,626 prescribed fires. Only 14 ended up escaping. So it's a minuscule number. So it's maybe something of concern. Maybe it's not as bad as people think it is. Well, what about what can be done to address kind of the challenges using a fire management plan? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Pedro Nava, the chair of California's Little Hoover Commission, about a recent report entitled Fire on the Mountain that argues that forest fires, if properly managed, will result in healthier forests and fewer out-of-control wildfires. A big concern, however, is how forest fires, even the ones that are managed, impact carbon emissions and air pollution. We talked about that earlier. So people may not be aware of the fact that California forests are among the largest carbon sinks that we have in the state. They absorb and store a lot of carbon. Can you talk a little bit about that? What are the numbers?
Right. Well, and I'm going to refer to my notes. So, for example, in 2010, the above-ground plants for our forests stored about 898 million metric tons of carbon. Mm. And those are really important in sequestration. But we lose that when we have the wildfire. So, for example, between 2001 and 2010, we lost about 180 million metric tons of carbon due to those disturbances. Now,
so I'm doing the math quickly on this. They said something like 53 metric tons equals 11 million cars. So three times that, 33 million cars.
Right, right. And think about it.
That's a lot of cars.
It's a lot of cars, and it really works against how sincere California is in reducing greenhouse gases. And we have a leadership role in the world in technology and application of reducing greenhouse gases. But it makes no sense for us to ignore one of the places where we are losing our ability to sequester carbon by not taking care of our forests.
I think your report says something like 25% reduction since the early 1900s in carbon capture.
Right, and if you were to break that down into dollars and cents, how much more money do you think we would have to spend to recover that 25%? Either in different applications of technology or in how we change our behavior. So if you want to, I guess what I'm saying is that healthy forests work hand in hand with the reduction of greenhouse gases and carbon capture.
Yeah, see, you really see this as a system. It's not just discrete issues.
Right.
It all works together.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. Wildfires don't count against air quality standards, right, but prescribed fires that you right. manage do.
Right.
And so they all increase levels of PM2.5, which are those very, very small particles of air pollution that get in your lungs, that are in your bloodstream, that can
right.
be very damaging. So how do you change public perception on this issue?
Well, we have a wonderful example, and that is what California did in terms of the drought. It used to be that people really didn't care too much about where water came from and believed that they had enough water to last forever and ever and ever. Well, we had a drought, and it's been dramatic, and it's been significant. And so California, with the State Water Resource Control Board and with water districts throughout the state, agreed to put together a public education plan about saving California water. And it has been a tremendous success. And a few years ago, you might not have thought that it would have made much difference, but it does. We think you can do the same thing with the forest. We think that when you explain to people how important it is for California in terms of their air quality, their water quality, their recreational opportunities, that they'll begin to understand that one-third of our state is something that's precious and needs to be protected.
Yeah, I think they would focus on not the short-term implications of air quality, but the long-term implications.
Right.
And the other issue, too, you kind of touched on this, is that the larger trees have a bigger impact on air quality, you know, carbon sequestration, than the smaller ones.
Right.
So that's kind of important as well. So you've got this thing called a forest carbon plan.
Right.
Goals are calling for 500,000 acres of non-federal land and 500,000 acres of Forest Service land per year be kind of fixed.
Mm-hmm.
Another 10 to 15,000 acres of Bureau of Land Management a year be addressed.
Right.
That's like double the current standards. How likely is that to happen?
Listen, you've got to reach for the stars. I mean, it is going to be difficult, and it is going to be complicated. But quite frankly, most things that are worth doing, they are. If it were easy, it would have been done already by somebody else. But again, if we take a look at the economics, $200 an acre for a prescribed burn, over $800 for a forest fire. Either pay me now or you pay me later. And so we're going to need continued work with the Good Neighbor Authority to work cooperatively with the federal government and with private landowners to move forward in meeting those goals of addressing those 500,000 acres on one end and another 500,000.
And it's really interesting what you're talking about, really, it really is about changing from a reactive policy to a proactive policy.
Now, it's costing us money now.
Right.
It's just that
but people don't think about it, right?
That's right. I mean, if you're responding to a forest fire and it's a crisis, everybody says, well, of course you have to pay that. But we also need to get people to start thinking about, why don't we just pay $200 now per acre instead of the $800 that you're going to have to pay later? And not only that, but the cost associated, the federal government is spending somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 billion a year on fire suppression in California. We can reduce that as well through an appropriate forest management plan.
So where does the Air Resources Board fit into all this?
Well, the Air Resources, again, as you mentioned, if you have a forest fire, then it's like the air is horrible, but it doesn't count against you as a local authority, local government. If you want to do a prescribed burn, then you have to calculate it very carefully. We need cooperation with the Air Board. One of the things that the Air Board does is they have many stationary monitors that evaluate the air quality. There now is, through technology, portable monitors and small units that can actually go to where you want to have the fire, that are going to be more accurate and give you the best information so that you can work cooperatively with the Air Board on when it is the best time to do a prescribed burn.
Okay, well, we're going to continue this conversation. What else can be done to tame California's wildfires? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Pedro Nava, chair of California's Little Hoover Commission, about a recent report they did entitled Fire on the Mountain, basically talking about fighting fire with fire. One of your recommendations, though, is to better utilize the wood being removed from forests. Can you give me some examples of that?
Yeah, as I mentioned, a healthy forest has between 50 and 80 trees per acre. What we have now in some areas is 300 to 400 an acre. And so it's very small diameter lumber. They're not large trees. But in some areas, they've proven that they can be harvested, and they can be prepared and then used as laminate.
Oh.
And so, California imports 80% of its wood products. We have a third of our state is forest, but we bring in 80% from other places. So we think one of the ways to help with the rural economies is to take these smaller trees and turn them into usable wood products. And in fact, the Tree Mortality Task Force does have a part of that group that is looking at doing that. And it's one of the ways that we can help rural economies and taking the material that is growing there as we thin our forests.
But isn't one of the problems, though, the sawmills are kind of shutting down?
It is true, but you can have smaller scale sawmills using current technologies and put some of that wood to use.
You also talk about biomass as kind of an energy source. It sounds like it's going down. They're not using it as much as they used to.
Yeah, biomass has a whole host of its own kind of unique, people like the word challenges, in that it tends to be more expensive per kilowatt hour. There has to be an assessment of what they call least cost best fit. But biomass facilities, if they're using current technology, can reduce what they emit, can generate energy, and under the right circumstances, that can be sold back into the grid. But that's not going to be easy.
Yeah, but it's also kind of a cost benefit thing, right? It's we probably would prefer, wind or solar or something like
right.
that, but in these situations, to help deal with the forest issue, we need to get rid of this wood somehow. This is, on balance, probably the right thing to do.
Well, the conversation really has to be, again, least cost, best fit. What we've done in energy in California is focused almost exclusively on least cost. But if you take into consideration the point that you made with best fit, how does that contribute to the community? If you are taking material from the forest that you don't have to transport statewide,
right,
thereby reducing greenhouse gas in transport, and then using it to generate energy, you might actually come out with a better cost per kilowatt.
Yeah, net positive. So you talk about education too. I want to briefly touch on that. So it's kind of the Save Our Water campaign, and I think in your report it says it's almost only $16 million. That in the scheme of things, that's pretty inexpensive.
Yeah, I mean when you think about the benefits that can come about from managing our forests appropriately. and educating the public. You know, the other side benefit to that is you begin to really understand how marvelous California is. That you've got a third of your state that is forest. That you've got people who make their livings in the forest. You know, a forest in some of these rural communities is their Disneyland. It's their industrial center. It's their manufacturing center. It creates jobs for people who live in those places. They tend to be overlooked because they're rural and they're hard to get to. But I really do think one of the ways to honor everything that California is you have to recognize how important the forests are.
Now I want to ask you this last thing about the governor's tree mortality task force. What would you like to see them do?
We'd like to see them continue with this marvelous example of cooperation that they've demonstrated so far. The governor in his State of the State made reference to forming a forest management group. We think you can take the lessons and some of the people and some of the entities. There's 80. Can you imagine convening a meeting with like 80 representatives? There's 80 representatives in that tree mortality task force. They have figured out how to work together, how to trust each other, and how to keep their eyes focused on results. And you take all of those lessons, transfer some of those over to the forest management new effort, and I think that you're a long way towards success.
Well, I'd like to thank our guest, Pedro Nava, with the California's Little Hoover Commission for joining us. Always enlightening. This is Mark Kepler for the Matty Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed on the Matty Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Matty Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on the Matty Report, visit our website at mattyinstitute.org.
The Matty Report. Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.